Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Women in Jazz, the new podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of female jazz musicians. I'm your host, Irani Nejvetsky, and each month I'll sit down with a different professional jazz musician to discuss what got her into jazz, her experience developing as a musician, and what life is like as a professional jazz musician today. Before I introduce our first guest, I'd love to give a huge shout out and thank you to the Shake 'Em Up Jazz Band for allowing us to use their recording of the song A Woman's Place Is in the Groove for our introduction. This tune was originally composed by bassist Vivian Gary and recorded by her quintet in 1948, and I think it's a perfect fit for this podcast. You can check out the Shake 'Em Up Jazz Band at shakeemupjazzband.com and shakeemup.bandcamp.com. I'll also put a link to these in the show notes. Now, I'm very excited to introduce you to our first guest here at Women in Jazz, the amazing Jen Hodge. Jen is a double bass player from Canada who has spent the majority of her life as a professional musician based in Vancouver. Since the time of our interview, Jen has relocated to New York City, where she's hit the ground running and is playing gigs all over the town. Jen also wanted me to let our listeners know that since the time of recording, she has finally played in Quebec, leading a band at the Cat's Corner Exchange, an annual swing dance festival in Montreal. Just a small warning about the episode, we had some audio issues recording. So if things seem a little disjointed in the first 10 minutes particularly, as well as the latter part, that's why, and apologies. Please bear with me. I'm still learning how this whole podcast thing works. Anyway, that's enough from me. Here's my chat with Jen. Nice. So it's really cool to get to have a chat with you about this stuff. I'm really happy to be able to welcome you to this project. And I'm really glad that you said yes, because I think it's going to be really cool for people to hear your perspective. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad you asked me to participate.
Cool. I actually don't know much about what your life is like at the moment. So you're living in Vancouver and gigging a lot there, or what's the setup?
Yeah, I've been based in Vancouver for a long time. I moved there in 2002 to go to school when I was 17. Mm-hmm. And I've been based there ever since. I more and more spend less and less time there. I have been thinking about relocating, to be honest. But
okay.
For this present moment, I'm still based in Vancouver, and
yeah, right.
I kind of spend an equal amount of time gigging in Vancouver and Seattle, and then I spend a lot of time traveling as well, especially on the weekends.
Yeah, okay. So you're not from Vancouver, though. Where'd you grow up?
I'm from a small-ish town on Vancouver Island. Vancouver itself is on the mainland, and then Vancouver Island is a big island close by, and the town I'm from is called Courtenay, British Columbia. It's a lovely place.
Is it quite quiet and mellow, or...?
Yeah, there's, you know, people talk about island time as well. I guess it's like an island phenomenon.
Yeah,
it's like 3-ish hours north of the capital city of British Columbia, which is Victoria, at the south end of Vancouver Island. Courtenay's halfway up. So it's a little bit isolated. So like the ferry takes an hour and 40 minutes to cross, and it's quite expensive. So it is quiet. More and more people are moving over there, though. Hopefully nobody on Vancouver Island would get too upset to hear me say that I would love if they built a bridge. They could do it.
Is that like a controversial local topic?
Yeah,
or something?
People over there vehemently don't want it to be easy to access because they like that it's quiet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you would like it just so you could go back and hang with family? Or
Exactly. Yeah, well, okay. And you know, it's prohibitive to do gigs over there because the ferry is so expensive and you have to work that cost in. And yeah, it's a bummer for me because I'm from there. I'd like to go there more often, and it just kind of doesn't work out as often as would be nice.
Yeah, okay. So what was life like growing up there? Did you start playing music when you were young, or what was your exposure to music in the first instance?
Well, we always had music in the house. Both of my parents are amateur musicians. My dad plays guitar, and my mom plays flute. She played flute in the concert band. And she also plays English folk instruments. She's from England. So she plays English concertina and penny whistle and wooden flute, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and actually, before I picked up an instrument, I was very heavily involved in dancing.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, starting from when I was like 5 or 6, I was so into dancing. I took all the different kinds of dance classes that were offered, and I started playing music when I hit puberty and I was too embarrassed to go out of my house in a leotard to dance class.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like quite the jump. I guess it was it just outfit based? Like walking out of the house with a double bass or something doesn't really seem like people are going to be kinder to you or something. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty tall person. I'm like 5'9", and I've been this tall since I was 11. I kind of hit puberty earlier than the other girls my age, and I was hideously self-conscious. So it really was that with the dancing, because everybody else was so tiny, and I just stuck out, and I was huge, and I had hips and boobs, and it was just like, nobody look at me. Like,
So
yeah, I started showing up for dance class in like baggy t-shirts and like baggy shorts, and the teacher was like, I can't work with you like this.
Shit.
So yeah. And around that time, I started getting into 60s rock music, especially. Like, it was funny because people were saying, like, oh, you nerd, you listen to your parents' music. But my parents didn't listen to that. So like, it's totally from their time. But my mom listened to folk music mostly at home and classical music. And my dad was listening to, I don't know, all sorts of different. My dad was listening to a lot of like new age music at that time, like a lot of music made by synthesizers and that kind of thing. And when I like started hearing the Beatles and the Rolling Stones on the radio, like just one of the few radio stations that we could get in my town, I loved that. And I wanted
to. So it wasn't through their kind of exposure. It was your own compulsion then.
I remember going home one day and saying to my parents, do you guys have any Beatles music that I could listen to? And they were like, why do you want to listen to that? But we probably have some. Like, Yeah, they dug me out a dubbed cassette and I like wore it out.
Yeah, wow, how cool. So what instrument did you start playing then when you got into music? Were you just trying to replicate that sort of style, or did you start playing something else?
A lot of things kind of happened around the same time. So that was also around the time where I grew up, that you start band class if you elect to do that. And so I remember if you wanted to take band, you had to fill out a form and list your top three preferred instrument choices.
Shit, and I think we had the same kind of thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wanted to pick instruments that I could play in a rock band with, but that I could also be, because I had always wanted to be in the concert band. Like when the older kids came to the elementary school and like played in the concert band with the dorky sweaters and stuff, I was like, I can't wait till I'm in there. So when it came time to fill out that form, I wanted to pick instruments that I could play in both contexts. And I had figured I would play guitar, but it wasn't an option. You couldn't play guitar in the concert band. You could play electric bass guitar. They would give you tuba music. So I put electric bass as my first choice, and then percussion, and then saxophone. And I'm sure when they were going through the sheets, they were like, there's a kid that wants to play bass?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Go with it.
So, and then my cousin gave me one around that same time too. And so I started playing electric bass.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that was when I was 11. Mm-hmm. So it was great. You know, I had the opportunity to learn to read music at that time. And then I was also playing along with the 60s music that I was excited about at home. And
yeah, right. So you were sort of trying to teach yourself alongside the stuff that you were doing at school, or?
Yeah, exactly.
So this is around, what, 11, 12 or something that this?
Yeah, I was 11.
Bass? And then, so this is when you first learned to read music and first learned music. You hadn't done anything prior to that time.
Yeah, not really. I think I had tried piano lessons, but it wasn't for me.
It wasn't for you. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And so when did you make the transition then to playing double bass?
That happened when I was 16, when I was in grade 11. So as the kid that wanted to play bass, I had a lot of opportunities, which, you know, was just lucky. I didn't know when I picked bass that everyone needs a bass player and no one else wants to play bass. So I played in all of the different school ensembles, concert band, but also like all of the different jazz bands, because the other grades, often there just was nobody in there that wanted to play bass. So I was doing all of that up until my grade 11 year. And I made the senior jazz band, and the teacher said, well, now you're representing the school and we're playing jazz music, so you need to play the, he called it the real bass. and I was quite offended. I was like,
I can imagine, like, being 16 and having someone say that shit to you.
I was like, excuse me, the electric bass is just as real as that hulking great thing. And I mean, I really fancied myself as a rock star at that point in time. I was like, I don't want to play that bass.
Did you dress? So huge. Did you have a particular, like, style of dress that was in line with your fancies?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I had, at that time when I was 16, it was also like 2000, 2001, and I loved those jeans that had the, like, enormously wide legs. Like, I did, like, fit kind of my waist or my hips and then flare out, and then I had these, like, tiny little t-shirts that I'd wear. That was my look.
Did you have skate shoes as well? Was that a thing?
Totally had skate shoes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, we definitely had the same sense of fashion.
Nice. I also had these shoes that I loved that were, like, I hated the Spice Girls, but I did like their shoes. And I had these, Spice Girls sneakers. Yeah. They were, like, runners, but they had, like, a 5-inch platform.
I had a pair like that as well. I think they were my favorite shoes.
They were so amazing. So great.
My mom still wears shoes like that. I'll cut that out in case she ever listens to this, though. She'll probably think I'm judging.
Where does she find them?
The internet. Yeah. She's an avid eBay shopper. So, you know, if you're ever missing those days and looking for a pair of platform sneakers, just let me know and I'll get my mom onto it for you.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to know that you can get Spice Girls shoes on the internet. That's great.
Yeah. She's very much, like, stuck in that late 90s, early 2000s fashion era, my mom.
Oh.
Anyway.
Cool.
Anyway. Sorry, I just cut you off, but I wanted to know what the transition was like from one type to the other.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was having this conversation with the teacher after the band auditions at the beginning of the year, and he's like, yeah, I mean, you're up. You're in the senior bands. You're representing the school, and we're playing jazz music. And you need to play the stand-up bass. And I was not very impressed, and I was probably a bit resistant. And he's like, the conversation ended with him saying, well, I mean, if you want to be in the band, that's the condition, and we've got our first performance in a couple weeks, so... Oh. Yeah, so you make up your mind. And so I wound up calling my mom and saying, like, Mom, I need to get picked up from school. I have to bring a double bass home. And I took it home for the weekend, like, first weekend into the semester of school. And I practiced it all weekend. And by the end, I was like, oh my God, this instrument is so much fun. I better not tell anybody. It's going to ruin my image.
Wanted to stay cool.
Yeah.
So you were playing jazz at that point, but were you particularly interested in it? Like, had you really gotten into any, or were you still sticking with your love of Beatles? And
it was really starting to play the upright bass that really got me into jazz, because I had been in all of the various school jazz bands before that, but I wasn't captivated by any of the music that we were playing to the point that I was, like, excited to go home and listen to jazz. It was really after I started playing upright bass. And then another thing that happened there was that, so I was in grade 11, and there was a bunch of people in grade 12, like a year ahead of me, that were also in the senior jazz band that were really into jazz. And they asked me to play with them in, like, they just put a small group together for outside of school for fun, because they wanted to, like, really play jazz. Mm. And being the bass player, especially since I was playing the quote unquote real bass all of a sudden, they asked me to play with them. And that was a great thing. That they were so stoked on jazz that they'd put together these, like, one of them lived on Hornby Island, which is a smaller island that you have to take another ferry to get to from Vancouver Island. And we would all go over to that guy's house for, like, an entire weekend at a time. And they had, like, a shed or something, and we would just set up in there and spend the whole weekend playing and listening. And these guys had recordings. They had, like, a bunch of Miles Davis and Cannonball Adderley. That was, like, kind of my gateway, because I wouldn't have known where to start. But yeah, like, we would just hang out and listen to that stuff and then try and play those tunes. And yeah, that was really when I started to love jazz.
Yeah, right. And where was the first place that you really felt like you found your inspiration as a bass player within that music?
I got some scholarships to go to jazz camps the summer following that. Okay. Like, I guess I picked a lot of things up quickly about it or something like that. So the summer after I started playing stand-up bass, I think I went to 3 or 4 jazz camps. Like, I spent most of the summer in jazz camps that I got given scholarships for. And that was very inspiring because, actually, this is definitely relevant. The bass instructor at the first one, it was a 2-week camp, and the bass instructor was a woman called Jody Prosnick, who is a total badass and my good friend now too. And she's a very inspiring person. She like really loves music, and just spending that time with her, I remember at the end of the 2 weeks, she said, "The amount of improvement that I've seen in you in these 2 weeks is like typical of a year's worth of play." Like, it was just like having somebody that really knew their stuff give me these pointers, and I was able to kind of whoop, get way better. And I wouldn't hear as well
when you're passionate about something, to have that kind of validation from someone that you look up to.
Yeah, exactly. And I doubt I even thought about it much at the time, but she was the only woman on that faculty. And from there, I went to 2 or 3 other camps that summer. And I think having had the pointers that she had given me, it definitely set me up to excel in those other camps too. And
she sounds like an important influence. So you went to this jazz summer camp, and this was before you'd finished school already?
Yeah, that was the summer before my final year. And I had a similar summer the following one before I went to music school in the big city.
So, so by this point, around this time, had you very much decided that you were going to go on to study music at uni or at university, college,
whatever you call it?
What do
definitely.
You call it in Canada, actually?
Either university or college, depending on the institution.
Right.
Yeah. I had long, long ago decided that. Like, when I started playing electric bass when I was 11, I had the full intention of making a career out of it when I picked it up.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Did that ever waver?
No, it never has.
How amazing.
Yeah, for better or for worse.
I think that's really interesting. I think a lot of people that I've talked to have definitely gone through periods in their kind of artistic life or career where they have considered doing other things or have doubted the path that they're on. To not have that is interesting. Do you feel like there's any particular reason? Is it just the environment that you were in made it seem possible, or...
Maybe. I mean, I definitely feel discouraged sometimes, but I think I just can't imagine myself
doing anything else.
Yeah, I can't imagine myself doing anything else and feeling particularly authentic about it. I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, I feel like I'm supposed to make music and I don't feel like I'm done.
Yeah, okay. That's cool.
And yeah, I mean, music is something that the more you do it and the more you work at it, like, there's always room for you to get better. Even the greatest musician in the history of the world could still get better. Like, there's a quote from the cellist Pablo Casals that always really resonated with me, where someone asked him in his old age why he still practiced every day. And he said, "Because I think I'm making progress."
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so I think I'm still making progress.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I think if you're in any sort of creative field, in order to keep wanting to be there, you have to always be working on improving and changing. So in terms of the style of music that you played, you said you were playing jazz sort of at the end of your high schooling years and then going on to study. Were you, what style of jazz were you into at that time? And what was your experience in university like? Did that shape or change your preferences much?
Yes, I would say it did. It was not an easy time going through that program. It was the program, I mean, I've been out of post-secondary context for 12 years. I graduated in 2007. Mm. And the farther away I get from it, the more I feel there's just so many things that don't make sense about institutionalized music. On the other hand, coming from where I came from, that was really the option for me, really. Mm. But like, especially jazz doesn't really make that much sense in that context. Like it being a communal type of music and a tradition that, at least in theory, gets passed on to the younger generations by people that already know how to do it, you know, like being in a institutional context is weird because you're with all of these people that are in the same boat as you. It makes way more sense to learn in a context where you're the weakest link.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
Yeah. I had an epiphany before my final year of my degree where I had a summer job where I was working with French-Canadian exchange students, where it was basically my job to hang out and speak English with these people from Quebec, most of whom were around my age. It was a great job. But after that, a few of them that had intended to stay in Vancouver for the summer and work and further hone their English abilities, they didn't anticipate how expensive living in Vancouver was, so they were gonna have to move back. And I was like, you know what, like, at that time I was living by myself. I was like, everybody move into my apartment, we'll have the cheapest rent for like 2 or 3 months, and the condition is I've just helped you all learn to speak English. When we're in the apartment, French only, so that I can learn.
Yeah, cool. And yeah, I
totally could not have a conversation in French at the start of that. But by the end of that, I totally could.
Wow.
And it felt the same as playing music, especially playing jazz, where like you're hearing sounds, you're replicating them, you're learning to hang in the in the conversation, to like be immersed in it and to be able to react with your own ideas in that context. And that really gave me this epiphany of, if I had just moved to somewhere where jazz is part of the culture, I would be so much further along than I am having gone to this school.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Do you think there were things sorry to interrupt. I mean, I find that already, one thing I find that massively inspiring, especially as someone who's been living in a mostly French-speaking house for about 6 months and still can't speak more than a few words or maybe shitty sentences in French. So that's pretty impressive. But I think like that sort of more traditional educational environment, do you think that did provide anything for you that you couldn't have got externally or might have found more difficult to get externally that was useful going forward?
Definitely the most useful thing I got out of going to that program was meeting all of the people that I did there, because many, many of the people I met and friends that I made in that program are people that I still work with and I'm still close to. Evan Arntzen and I were in the same year, and through him I met his whole family. That family's provided a significant portion of my living over the years.
Okay, yeah.
And yeah, Bria Skonberg was a year ahead of me. Lots of different people that I met there are people that I'm still friends with, that I still work with. Okay. So that was the best thing. Yeah, and I mean, it never hurts to learn skills or information. Like, for example, the arranging classes, I wouldn't have had that otherwise. And yeah, like, that's very valuable for sure. I think learning theory and learning history is very valuable.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting point, because I think jazz is a social art form. It's interesting that you make this point, because I feel like from the people that I've spoken to in the jazz community that exists now, in a lot of it, it's not as much of a social art form as it used to be. Like, the nature of playing on stage and maybe improvising together with a band is a social art. And yes, you are playing with others, but I guess culturally it's quite removed from a lot of its roots now.
Yeah, which is a shame. Actually, something that I love so much about playing for dancers is that it feels like such a collaborative thing.
Just to interrupt, because I don't know if people who are listening to this, if anyone's from outside of swing dance land. So just to clarify that you play for swing dancers, partly. That's one of the things that you do with your music.
I do, yeah. And I've gotten to a point where I do quite a lot of those gigs all over the place. And yeah, I feel like what both parties are doing, like, that's when that art form is being practiced completely, I think, when the musicians and the dancers are like reacting to one another.
Yeah.
That's collective improvisation in a really whole way.
Mm-hmm. And were you drawn to doing that because of the style of jazz that you were sort of preferentially into? Or what was the sort of chicken and egg kind of thing there? Did you go into university, for example, with different tastes in jazz and then come out with, you know, being into swing and therefore playing for how, like, how did all that fit together?
Because I didn't grow up with jazz at all, I more went into it with a curiosity about what is jazz. And the stuff that I was exposed to first, admittedly, is music that I prefer less than some of the other kinds that I've come across. Like, not to say that I don't love it, because I love all of it. I love music. But I would totally listen to a Count Basie, Lester Young record before I listened to a Miles Davis record.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And playing for dancers, it just kind of happened. We've been really fortunate in Vancouver. It's a really lovely community. I think that has lots to do with it. I think I played my first, I played my first like traditional jazz gigs probably while I was in my first year of school. Some of the friends that I met right off the bat, who I already mentioned, Bria Skonberg, Evan Artson, they had a band and they were like working. They were playing festivals on the weekends that they were getting flown to even back then.
Wow.
Yeah. And I can remember, like, it would have been within the first few weeks of meeting these people. I remember Bria mentioning, like, oh, we've got a gig on the weekend. And I was like, cool, can I come to it? And she's like, well, it's kind of, I don't know if you'll like it. It's kind of, like, she's used to people thinking, like, oh, that's dorky music. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that sounds cool. I went and I was like, oh, this is fun. I like this. And, you know, they were playing traditional and New Orleans stuff like Tiger Rag and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought it was fun. And I think they all were used to other jazz people kind of teasing them and saying like, oh, that's dorky. It's not cool. So the fact that I was into it meant that when their tuba player couldn't make it, they called me to play bass. And
cool.
So like I got into that just through my friends and you know, it was fun. People liked it. I think that there's a lot of value in that. But there was like a bunch of dancers back then that used to go to these traditional jazz festivals to dance. And somewhere along the line, those people found us and started hiring different combinations of us to play for the dances. And then they would kind of teach us about how the feel is different and how the... this swings and it's got lots of energy. But like, listen to these Count Basie and Roy Eldridge and Jimmy Lunsford recordings. And then like it was kind of because we made friends with all these people, really, and like
everybody were giving you information that informed your music.
Yeah, exactly. And then I mean, it is cool that like everybody had a very friendly attitude about that kind of thing.
Was it because the stuff that they were talking about you wouldn't have stumbled onto yourselves, or they just had different preferences that kind of opened the scope of things that you're interested in? Like how?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was both of those things. Like they'd show us things, or we'd like observe what they played on the set breaks and be like, oh, that's a cool tune. Let's go ask the DJ what it was and then we can learn it. Or it's just cool that there was that attitude among the whole community. Like if we did things that weren't what they needed, there wasn't just like a weird resentment or they don't hire us again. Everybody's been willing to talk for the most part in this community, which I think has been extremely beneficial for both parties. Because the more that I travel and do those kinds of gigs, the more I see like, oh, it's atypical for there to be as much integration between the musicians and the dancers in the same community as we've had, I feel like.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think that's really cool. So then to backtrack a little bit, you said earlier that some of that music that your friends were playing for dancers is perceived as a bit nerdy or whatever by other jazz musicians. And what do you think it is that fuels that perception?
That's been a source of frustration for me for a long time. And I don't know how many other places that divide happens in. I mean, it's all music. It's all jazz. It's all great. Why would we be a snob about that? I think in this part of the world, it feels like there's a bit of a disdain for having fun, or like...
it's not intellectual enough or something.
I guess so, which I just don't identify with at all, especially in the particular time in history we're in. There's just so much horrible stuff happening everywhere all the time. We need that expression of joy. We, like, everybody needs that. It's very healing. It's very cathartic. It's, I think it's important. And also, there's absolutely room to be happy and intellectual at the same time. Those things are not mutually exclusive.
No, they shouldn't be.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're, I don't know. It just, I just don't, clearly I don't identify.
No. It's a curious thing. I think that that is a trend in many places, that some of these earlier styles are perceived as sort of being less than by a lot of musicians. And I do wonder sometimes where that comes from, whether it's about the education system that they kind of go through, whether it's about the experience that they have as musicians playing it and like the type of difficulty that exists in the music for them. Like, I wonder, or if it's just like a cultural thing, or if it's just, the being happy and intellectual is like, people don't, those two things like fly in the face of each other too much for people's brains. I don't really know, but
Yeah. And also the fact that it gets perceived as being antiquated is something that I find a shame too, because I really feel that any kind of jazz in practice, it's a living and breathing tradition. I mean, it would be like calling, say, Irish folk music old or antiquated. And probably a lot of people do that. I'm sure people that are in that world get that all the time. But I think people that actually practice it don't feel that it's old and antiquated. Like, it's just music. It's a living, breathing thing.
It's such good music, too.
It is. It is. And I mean, every time you play, it's different. There's something different about it. And whether that's the notes that you play, or whether that's the context that you're playing in and the other people you're playing with and who's there hearing it and reacting to it, it's not old. It's like, it's a tradition, you know?
Yeah.
And there's less and less room for traditional practices in our culture these days, which, I mean, it's sad. I can't help but feel like at some point we have to see that change, because it's just a part of being human, having culture that we share and participate in communally.
Do you wonder if now maybe that's a little bit because we are sort of more connected than we ever used to be in a way? There's more dissemination of information, and people kind of can find their tribes more easily, so that you just sort of have like a dissipation of culture, you know, that everything just sort of has diffused out into this big mess and it's harder to build strong traditions.
I don't know what it is. I mean, yeah, we do spend more time on connecting with each other through technology. I don't know, it's not the same. I don't know if these social ways of connecting via technology are here to replace connecting with people in person, or if we just haven't really found the right balance of having both. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. And do you feel like there are also maybe more people around now kind of interested in playing the same stuff that you're currently playing? Or do you feel like you're losing people that are interested?
I feel like I've seen more musicians come into the fold to play swing and traditional jazz since I've been playing it, especially as the swing culture has snowballed globally, I would say, because I would have started playing swing dances probably like 2005 or something like that. I would say, I mean, certainly the community in Vancouver has grown since I started participating. There's definitely more bands and more musicians in Seattle, I would say, since I started, even though some of the people who were key players when I started playing down there have moved, I would say that there's a larger pool of musicians, I think.
And in terms of the demographics of people that are playing the music, has that stayed fairly the same, or has that changed, or?
Good question. From what I've been able to tell since I've lived here, it kind of seems like every so often there's like a wave of younger musicians that are interested in it that show up. My friends and myself being one, like, I can remember that the musicians that were older than us when we started playing it were like really excited that there were a bunch of young people playing it. And then about 5 years ago or so, there was this crew of people that were around 20 years old or so that started showing up to all our gigs and sitting in. And it was like, now I'm in the role of the people that were giving me a chance 10 years ago. Cool.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And then that seems to come a little bit back to what you said earlier about learning and the best way to learn being to be the worst person in the room, basically, like to be the least experienced person in the room. So are you mindful of that as you play?
Yes. Yeah, I think about that a lot, for sure. I mean, nowadays I do a lot of band leading. I always try to hire the very best musicians that I can. And then I also endeavor to give opportunities to the younger people that are excited about the music, that have the fire and have the interest. And I try and throw them in with people that have way more experience than they do. And then it's very gratifying to watch them get better at an exponential rate. It's great.
Yeah. So since you finished your degree, you have just been working as a gigging musician, or have you also been an educator? Because I know that a lot of musicians also become music teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an important part of, especially of being a jazz musician. I think of being any kind of musician, mentoring is really important. Mm. And I have done that. I've never had like an institutional teaching job or anything like that. Mostly I'm just not good at mornings and I travel so much and I want to be doing that. Like, I don't want to be in one place all the time at this particular point in my life. So I haven't gone that route, but I do adjudication and like workshopping at educational band festivals and that kind of thing. And I have taught private lessons. I'm not doing very much of that these days. Just my schedule isn't compatible with most other people's. It's like, yeah, we can totally do a lesson. How about Tuesday at 1 p.m.? Oh, you have work or school? That makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
And they're like, how about on the weekend? Well, no, I'm never in town on the weekend. Yeah. Yep. So it's just not how it's worked out very much for the past few years. But when young people come to my gigs, I definitely like throw them in, and then I'm more than happy to spend hours answering their questions in those contexts.
Do you feel like the jazz community in general is good at that? Or do you feel like that's an area in which it could improve?
Probably both of those things. I mean, I definitely learned a great deal from being a young keen musician in those contexts with more experienced musicians who were willing to do that for me. So like, it's been there, at least in some capacity in my life. But there's probably also people that don't have that approach as much. I don't know.
Okay.
I think also in this culture here anyway, learning that way isn't so much what people automatically think to do. Like, if a young person's interested in music, it's more like, well, then you're going to go to university for music, instead of then you're going to go to as many shows as possible and hear as much music as possible and like follow around musicians who you admire and try to pick their brains. And it doesn't necessarily occur to people.
Yeah, okay.
It's maybe as much on the people that want to learn as it is the people that already know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it doesn't occur to people, maybe? They're just too busy playing their music? Or, like, is there something else in that? Or
I think it's a cultural thing here anyway. Like, what's perceived as Canadian politeness, quote unquote, often that's just like a... Canadians definitely don't want to impose on anybody, so they're less likely to come up to you and say, hey, I'm really interested in what you're doing and I want to talk to you. Like, they're more like, oh, I don't want to bother that person. I'll just figure this out my own.
Interesting. And how, so then you mentioned the Canadian environment, but you've played in other places and played, I'm sure, like quite a lot in the States. What has your experience been like of playing in America, and how does that compare?
I think Americans are culturally more outgoing. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Like, for me, for one reason or another, I love people interacting with each other, and I love people being loud and outgoing.
And that works for me. How does that manifest itself in the way they interact in the jazz world?
often the crowds are like louder, more like outwardly responsive. I mean, there's so many different cultures within the United States too that it's not the same everywhere, but yeah, I can remember doing gigs in Bellingham, which Bellingham, Washington is, if you go when there's no traffic, 45 minutes south of Vancouver, just across the border. And I remember being so struck by how different it felt to play there versus at home, in that people would respond to what you play something and people yell, or you finish a song and people yell and react, and more people would come up and say, oh, I like this, or like, hey, do you know this Fats Waller song? I can remember playing at this bar in Bellingham and a lot of college students were there, and I remember there was a bunch of college football dudes, and one of them came up to us and said, hey, do you guys do Ain't Misbehavin'? I love Fats Waller. And I was like, what? No way ever would a big, cool jock come up to me anywhere that I've ever been in British Columbia and say, I love Fats Waller, can you play Ain't Misbehavin'? And it's just maybe just
that's amazing. I feel like that's I feel like that's just going to be an incredibly uncommon experience anyway. That sounds like.
But I guess it's cool. American music, so it's more on everybody's radar, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. As a also non-American, I can't speak for them. I mean, one thing I find in Europe, in the places that I've spent a lot of time in, is that it seems like jazz is, that sort of era in particular, is played quite a lot, just in cafes and shops and stuff. I find that really striking, especially going around in Brussels and going into shops and just being like, what? There's jazz music just everywhere. It's sort of just low key in the background. And I haven't really experienced that anywhere else, which I find really odd.
Yeah, I've played, they love it in France. I feel like it seems like it's a bit part of the culture there in some way or another.
It had its own life there as well.
Exactly. I think that's part of it. Like Sidney Bechet showed up and everybody loved him and everyone still loves him. And it maybe on the continent too, people are, I mean, I think there's a lot of British influence in Canada. So that's maybe a thing too, that since the British culture is more reserved and quote unquote polite, I don't know, outwardly expressing enjoyment of rhythm is it's a little freaky to
I love that little caption, outwardly expressing enjoyment of rhythm. I'm gonna use that.
Okay, cool.
That's really nice.
Whereas I feel like on the continent people are less nervous about that, maybe.
Is there a difference then between French Canadian jazz culture and more British? Have you noticed anything different there?
Well, I've unfortunately not had the opportunity to play this kind of music in Quebec.
Okay.
I've done one tour out there and it was with a French-Canadian singer-songwriter, which was really great. It was wonderful. I can't wait to go back there. But it's funny, the different regions of Canada are quite insular and it's difficult to get around in Canada. And I just haven't had that. I mean, that's a whole tangent I could go on. But French-Canadian culture is very different than Anglo-Canadian culture. There's very old rifts between them too. There's definitely cultural tension there. But typically, French-Canadian culture is a little more European. It's definitely a little more rowdy, a little more laid back.
Okay, sounds fun.
It's great. It is. I highly recommend going to Quebec. It's great.
Yeah, cool. All right, I do want to talk about your experience band leading, or like, what have you been working on in your music in more recent years? Like, what is your focus?
Yeah, I have been doing a lot of band leading. I'm actually at what feels like a bit of a juncture right now too, where I had this weekly Wednesday night gig in Vancouver for a little over 8 years, and it's just recently dialed back from weekly to monthly. So I have it's a big change. I've also long said that gig is the primary reason I've continued to be based in Vancouver, so there's some like big questions on the table. Yes, yeah, it feels very much that way. But I mean, having that gig every week for so long, I really took as an opportunity to just constantly be bringing in new tunes and learning as much of the repertoire as I could get my hands on, and like teaching it to the body of players that I used to play that gig, or writing charts. And often new arrangements would come out of playing them there, or I would just, you know, have these ideas and like every week be able to try new things. So that gig has been amazing for that. And I feel doing that gig, I've been able to improve so much as a bass player and as a band leader and as a vocalist and as a musician in general.
Yeah,
so that's been really great. So not having that gig every week now means a change. It also means that I can possibly put my creative energy into maybe a new project, or yeah, I've been the past couple months able to play other Wednesday gigs that I haven't been able to do for a long time. Like, and anything's possible. Like,
it just means that there's kind of some change and you need to find out how you're going to manage this new layer of the land. But, you know, it brings opportunity to do something different rather than playing by the same rules.
Yeah, which is exciting. There's a lot of music that I love that I haven't had the opportunity to play because of the needs of the gigs that I've been doing. Like, and then also, I just recently wrote a lot of arrangements for the biggest Lindy Hop event in Western Canada. It's called Lindy Bout. It just happened this past weekend, beginning of April.
Cool.
Yeah, and this was the second year in a row that they ran a competition that they called the All That Jazz competition, where the concept is that we in the band play many different types of jazz, but not jazz that one would ever Lindy Hop to. It wouldn't make musical or dancing sense. So that's the second year that I've done that, and I put a great deal of time and care and effort into writing the arrangements for that. And it's all music that I love that I totally don't have the opportunity to play most of the time. And since I've got 2 years worth of arrangements now, that's like each competition that was 8 tunes. So that's, if we're taking solos in a jazz club context like we would, that's more than enough material for one night. I'm thinking like, oh, I've been trying to think of a name that I could call that project. I could like totally look for gigs where I'm playing like Charles Mingus tunes and like classic Blue Note stuff that I love, that just
playing the full gamut of stuff that there is rather than any.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you get into band leading, actually? That just happened?
I mean, it just kind of happened. Yeah, I think I always had the personality to kind of go out and hustle for gigs. Mm-hmm. So then I would wind up being the person that got the gig. So then I'd be like, okay, guys, you know, I would just be the person with the information. So that kind of happened. I also, around the summer of 2006, with some friends from school, started a project called Company B Jazz Band, where we started out doing Andrew Sisters stuff. It was some vocalists from the school that I went to, and they asked me to be involved because I was already playing a lot of the kinds of gigs that they wanted to do, like the swing dance gigs and the traditional jazz festivals and stuff. And because I had the connections and I knew the music already, I wound up being the band leader for that group for the better part of 10 years. It's still going. I'm less involved currently, but yeah. And I was so stoked about digging into that music when Shannon Scott was the one who had the idea to start it. Her grandmother had given her a compilation of Andrew Sisters music. And it was interesting because, like, they never once came up during, like, she was studying jazz vocals and the Andrew Sisters never once came up at all.
At university?
Exactly. Yeah, she was at the point of graduating, and I think her grandma, who loved that music, said, like, oh, so you probably know all of this Andrew Sisters music by this point. And she's like, no, I've never heard of them. And so her grandma gave her this double CD set, and she was like, oh, this is so much more fun than any of the music we sang at jazz school.
How did they get missed? Like, is it an era thing? Or that seems really surprising to me, because I don't know. I feel like...
Yeah, I think it's just the music is too fun for that particular jazz program to think that it's worth looking at.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, I had a downer of a time at jazz school, but I think the vocalists had it even worse. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it was really, really not fun to be a
Other than the environment, is there something particular? Because you said much earlier that you didn't like the structure of that environment and you feel like you would have got more out of just going out and playing and actively being a musician in a bigger capacity than you were. But is there something else about that program that you found?
Yeah. It was just very narrow-minded, I feel. It was very bebop is acceptable and getting into like weirder, I don't know. There was certain types of jazz language was acceptable while others wasn't. And it was also like I was always interested in classical music too. Where I grew up, there was no orchestra anywhere near my town. So when I moved to the city, like I always practiced classical music and I took lessons from one of the bass players from the VSO for a while. And I can remember being told by one of the teachers at the school, if you want to be a jazz player, you shouldn't be putting time into playing classical music. And I'm like, how could that possibly take away? I want to be a musician. I love all kinds of music. How, like, why would you tell me to not work on something that I'm inspired by? Like, what a terrible thing to do. I can remember also in a combo class, one of the required tunes was Take the A-Train and put in time working on that tune by playing along with the famous recording of it. And I remember when it was recital time, I quoted a lot of the Raynaud's solo and the feedback I got was, you didn't play enough eighth note lines. And I'm like, well, it's Take the A-Train. It's like, it was basically like your solo wasn't complicated enough. I'm like, but it was good enough for Duke Ellington's band. Like, I mean, there's no way that I sounded nearly as good as I wasn't good enough to play in Duke Ellington's band, but the fact that there's no room for a melodic solo, it's not brainy enough, it's not complicated enough. Like, yeah, but it doesn't make nearly as much sense to play only running eighth notes over Take the A-Train. It's a melodic song.
Yeah. That's frustrating.
Just kind of not really a proper representation of jazz as a whole, you know?
Cool. And so going forward, to me, it seems like you're very clear on what your values are. And I guess, do you think about how you include that in the work that you do?
Yeah, I definitely keep my values pretty first and foremost. And I endeavor to make music that reaches people, that affects people, that like makes people feel something, because that's what I appreciate about music, I guess. And I endeavor to do that in a way that's artistically viable. So hopefully that comes across too. I try to make my gigs an enjoyable experience for the musicians that are playing it, as well as the people that are there experiencing it, whether they're doing so by dancing or drinking while they talk with their friends or sitting and paying attention. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think it's possible and to me important to say what you mean musically.
Were there times when you didn't, you compromised what you thought about music kind of personally, that you've kind of come through that period? Or
I mean, everybody has to do gigs that they don't find particularly inspiring sometimes. It's just part of being a working musician, I guess. Yeah, sometimes you have to, I don't know. I think you can even find ways to make the most unlikely gig for an artistic endeavor into one. You can usually find ways. And sometimes you just have to do what the client needs and go home and be like, well, it was annoying to not have as much artistic integrity or whatever, and move on.
Okay. Fair enough. Makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess I was going to ask you, like, what's a project that you've been involved in recently that you found like really exciting and inspiring?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mentioned that we just finished Lindy Bout in Vancouver. That's always really exciting and inspiring. It's so community oriented. It's so positive and fun and full of love. And I always walk away from that very inspired. I typically work very hard to get ready for it. And it was really gratifying to put in the work work and then present the music and have people dance and I don't know, it was really great. And writing those arrangements that I mentioned was exciting. That part of it has been really thrilling the past couple years because, as I said, I picked all music that I really love, that I'm really excited about, and I got to share it with this community that I play for all the time that wouldn't necessarily ever have happened upon any of that music. Plus, to play it and then have people come up and say, "What was that tune that went like this? I loved that. Where can I find it?" That's great because
that's really cool.
Yeah. I love it too. Isn't it great? I'd be so happy to send you a link.
Yeah. You seem to see, I mean, I've seen you play live really only at Lindy Focus, which, if people don't know, is another Lindy Hop event where they have a big orchestra that plays for several nights of the week, plays a bunch of charts. Mm. And I've seen Jen play at that event and also in some smaller groups as well. And you seem to inspire this sort of, I don't know, the audience responds so well to your playing. You inspire great excitement and energy in a crowd, which is really, I don't know if you, like, are you aware of that at all or that sort of really cool reception that you get, or are you just like blocking it out because it's, I don't know, or...
Well, that's really cool to hear. Thanks. I don't know. Hang on. I'm a little bashful all of a sudden.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to a certain extent I know what you're talking about. Yeah, people cheer loud for me at those things, which is extremely touching. I guess I am a pretty emotive player. Also, when you're the bass player, your job is to create and sustain a really great feeling beat, which is a great job.
It's such an essential thing, but I also feel like for that reason, bass players tend to fall a little bit under the radar, especially of a watching audience, unless you're in a really small group.
Right. I don't know. I think when I play the bass, my job is to make the music feel great for both the other musicians and for the audience, whatever type of audience it is. And so usually, therefore, I feel really great. So I think that I'm not somebody that hides that well or wants to hide that.
It do you just think people do hide it? Comes out. Do you think people hide that feeling?
I don't know. I don't know.
I think your joy is visible.
Yeah, I think I just enjoy it so much, and that helps other people feel whatever it is I'm communicating. And I think people respond well to that. It's cool. Yeah, I don't know.
I just made you bashful. Sorry.
Yes, you have. It's okay. Okay.
Yeah. I think it's a nice observation to make because I don't necessarily see people respond in that way to a bass player, especially when there's a huge fucking orchestra sitting there as well. I think it's quite an unusual thing. So I wondered if you were conscious of it and what that experience is like.
It is interesting. I haven't thought that hard about the way that people might react to me individually in that context. Huh. Food for thought, Irani. Thank you.
Cool. All right. Well, I think nice to end on a high with a nice feeling. But I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to say or...
Well, and we didn't really wind up digging into my finding the Boswell sisters through the Andrews sisters because that was really huge for me. They were virtuosic and so creative and just so daring and such brilliant musicians. When I found that stuff, I was like, why have I never heard of this? I just don't understand why this isn't on everybody's radar, and certainly why don't jazz vocal majors learn about them. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, they're pretty incredible.
Oh, I love them
really
so much.
Interesting harmonies. Well, there's also going to be an episode with me talking with Louise Messenger about the Boswell sisters a little bit too, so that's going to be cool.
Great. Yeah, I totally met Louise because of our mutual love for the Boswell sisters.
Yeah, nice. All right, well, that's nice for me. There's a little like cross episode plug there.
Cool. Exciting. Yeah, can't wait to hear that one.
All right. Well, is there anything else that you want to add?
I mean, the things that come to mind are along the lines of, like, I'm very grateful to get to do what I do, and it's really great. Being a full-time musician is far from being an easy existence, but it's extremely rewarding, and getting to connect with people all over the place and helping other people to connect with each other by playing music for them is pretty great.
Yeah, cool. That's nice. Okay, well, cool. I think we've got a lot of stuff. I'm going to do some fun editing now. And
yeah, thank you. I'm so delighted that you asked me to be a part of this.
Thanks again for listening. You can find out more about Jen and her music from the links I'll include in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode and you're invested in this project, it would help us a lot if you can like and share it. You can also follow us on Instagram with @women.in.jazz and on Facebook with @womeninjazzpodcast. Lastly, Women in Jazz is a not-for-profit podcast. In fact, I run it at a loss, paying for the equipment, the web hosting, and all that jazz. No pun intended. If you'd like to help keep this project running or are keen to see it grow, donations are welcome and super helpful. You can either contact us via our website or you can check out our new Patreon at patreon.com/womeninjazz. As well as updating our equipment and paying for costs, we'd love to be able to travel for interviews with more musicians, as we have a long list of incredible women we'd love to meet. Thanks again, and I hope you join us for our next episode.